Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to episode 583 with my guest, Gabe Howard. I am Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the bullshit rattling around in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas, and sexual dysfunction to everyday compulsive negative thinking. This show's not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I am not a therapist. It is not a doctor's office. More like a waiting room that doesn't suck. The website for this show is metalpod.com. Metalpod, also the social media handles you can follow us at. I have been feeling a bit out of it lately, and I'm not sure why. I haven't had a massage in probably over a year, and I got one on Monday, which would have been like 4 days ago. And I don't know, maybe it released a bunch of toxins into my body, but I've been feeling kind of run down and just spacey and kind of a vague sense of emptiness. This is getting more and more, I don't know, spiritually serious the more I talk about a feeling that life is meaningless and what is their point on this planet. No, not quite that bad, but just a feeling that something is off. And I thought, boy, that is a feeling that I bet a lot of people can relate to. And one of the reasons why I started this podcast was after I started getting sober and going to support groups, I realized that's just the tip of that's not the solution per se. That's just the set of tools to begin to figure out why I'm not running at 100% on any given day. And I guess I'm in one of those places where I don't really know, because I'm going to my support groups, I'm exercising, I'm half-ass meditating and half-ass yoga-ing. That's the school of yoga I go to, is with the yogi half-ass. I just feel like I'm going through the motions, and I've been through this before. I know it passes. That sense of vitality will come back at some point, but I hate that feeling of the things that normally bring you pleasure, you know, the excitement when you curl up on the couch and you got something to watch on Netflix. I look at Netflix, I'm like, nothing seems interesting. And so I've just been laying down at like 8 o'clock at night and I don't know. Let's read a survey. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Hi right now. And high as in H-I-G-H. And she says, just wondering if you'll ever switch up the surveys and or add more categories. Well, I am open to suggestions for new surveys that I could create, or questions that you would like to see added to surveys. So just under this survey, Ask Paul Anything. Send me any suggestions that you might have. Any comments to make the podcast better? I get so much out of your show. Thank you. My one observation would be that I don't often hear interviews or discussions with people who had a growing up similar to mine, which was no alcohol or drug abuse by my parents, but plenty with the children. No physical abuse and no verbal abuse in the sense of not much screaming or yelling. But my parents were very withholding and had extremely high expectations for their children, and their love was very conditional. I'm so glad that you mentioned that. First of all, I'm sorry that that was your experience, because sadly, that's really common. And I think that can be one of the hurdles to people having compassion for themselves, is they're like, well, I wasn't beaten. You know, I was fed. I was even, you know, given money for college. That's beside the point. That conditional love will do a fucking number on your brain. And there's an episode we did with Dr. Janice Webb about emotional neglect. She also has an incredible book about it called Running on Empty. So I recommend not only listening to that episode with her, it was from a couple of years ago, but read her book, because it is a real thing, and the effects of growing up with conditional love or emotional neglect is very fucking real and very, very far-reaching. So thank you. Thank you for your question and your suggestion. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by a woman who calls herself OCDing about my OCD medication, in the parentheses, as my therapist says. Hi, Paul, longtime listener, first-time surveyor. I have a question about medication and gut health. I've been on and off Prozac for about 10 years to treat OCD and depression. I'm currently off of it, but have been really struggling lately and went so far as to get the prescription again from my psychiatrist. So I have it in my hands, but I'm hesitating on starting it up again because I also struggle with an autoimmune disease and have a leaky gut. And that, for those of you that don't know, leaky gut is, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher this, but where if you have like an abundance of yeast or in other things, they can kind of worm their way into the lining of your gut, and then your gut kind of leaks, and it drains your energy. It fucks with your immune system. You feel run down. You get really bloated. Sometimes you can get diarrhea. I experienced that for about 10 years, and then I read a book called The Body Ecology Diet that kind of changed my life, and I totally revamped my diet, and it helped greatly. But back to her survey. I am slowly making dietary lifestyle changes to address the systemic inflammation in my body. But on days when I feel really low or depressed or stuck in an awful OCD spiral, I don't give a fuck about healthy eating. I'm stuck in this conundrum of needing to address and help my mental health, and Prozac has definitely helped in the past, but taking it might exacerbate my autoimmune struggles. I feel like a snake eating its tail. Super important question, and I don't feel qualified to truly weigh in on this. I would maybe go see an autoimmunologist. I think a really good call would be to go see a health practitioner, you know, maybe an Eastern health practitioner, because sometimes herbs can really address a lot of those things. As great as Western medicine can be, sometimes it's really not the best answer for things, because it can sometimes create additional problems, the side effects of them. But I am somebody that takes meds, and I don't believe it affects my gut in the way that you're describing, but every person is different. So I don't know if that helps. Was that a waste of time? Me reading that? Did I just make you more confused? This is from the racism survey filled out by TJ. And she is black. She is in her 50s. And she writes, the first experience I remember was when I was 5. I was walking home alone from school in a pickup truck full of what looked like grown men to me, yelled the N-word at me, and laughed as they drove past. I was scared to death that they were going to kidnap me. I never told my family because I had a father who never believed anything I said. Do you remember how you felt when it happened? Terrified and puzzled. I wondered why anyone would say something so threatening, and it does feel like a threat of violence to me, to a 50-pound child. How was I a problem for them? How do you feel about it now? Angry and hurt, because until then I felt comfortable walking alone. I live in an area where Trump flags fly on pickup trucks daily, even after he lost. I like to go for walks in my neighborhood, and seeing those trucks make me feel like that 5-year-old all over again. Yes, I know a lot of Trump supporters feel they aren't racist, but they should at least acknowledge that he ran on a platform that supports white supremacy, even if they chose to ignore it. I find their willingness to be complicit upsetting. I had a friend who was white tell me he would protect me. I told him, this is my country too. Why should I need your protection? He voted for Trump anyway and bought the MAGA hat. Yeah, so much for that. Any thoughts or feelings you'd like to share? I have 5 siblings. We have all done those things society says we need to be accepted. We have obeyed the law, went to college, worked hard, paid our taxes and debts, behave in a civil manner to our fellow citizens regardless of cultural background. In other words, exactly what we are told to do, which would disqualify us from being called that vile word. But in reality, we are still fair game for racist rants and name-calling. It is so incredibly depressing to know the truth is there is nothing I can do to change any of it. I just try to focus on being the kind of person I want to see in the world and hiding my disappointment in those who don't see me as human. Thank you for that. Not surprising. Not surprising. But, I think a lot of people like me who consider ourselves to be, a friend of minorities and marginalized communities, that we've heard everything there is to hear. We know, the plight of marginalized people. And then I read a survey like that and it brings, it makes it even more real to me, and it just reminds me that I don't think, if we want to be a friend to marginalized communities, I don't think we're ever done in having our ears open. And I don't know if that makes sense. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Delaney. And about her depression, she writes, it's like drowning, not for air, but for energy, clarity, and motivation. Holy fuck, is that a good one? And my God, do I relate to that. About her anxiety, feels like someone took my brain apart and put it back together completely wrong. Emotions don't match the stimuli, like a car that gives you radio when you want windows down and gives you the horn when you want wipers. I get no fully formed thoughts, just fragments. She struggles with heroin and fentanyl. For when feeling is too much, if I have crippling anxiety and depression, with that opioid buffer, how the fuck could I possibly deal without it? About narcolepsy, it really gets set off when I am anxious or stressed. I'm so sick of people telling me, get up and walk when you feel tired, or have you been checked for diabetes or hypothyroidism, etc., or did you not sleep last night? I do not feel it coming on. Yes, I've been checked for everything. Actually, I slept 11 hours plus last night, 11 hours last night plus a 2-hour nap after work every day. Narcolepsy is not fiction. It's a fucking nightmare. snapshot from her life. As soon as I notice that I've stopped thinking about killing myself, my anxiety kicks in because now I have to deal with everything I've been avoiding. And then I think, but if I kill myself, none of this matters. And the suicidal thoughts cycle back. This has been a continuous cycle for over a year. Well, thank you for that survey. That's a lot, man. That is a lot for a human being to be battling. And I really hope that you can get some support, because holy shit, how can one brain handle all that, especially when the very brain that is dealing with distortion is the sole source of information we're relying on to help it. And speaking of help, we are sponsored this week by BetterHelp Online Therapy. You know, people don't always realize that physical symptoms like headaches, teeth grinding, and even digestive issues can be indicators of stress. And let's not forget about doom scrolling, sleeping too little, sleeping too much, undereating, and overeating. Stress has definitely been something that has been in my life, and it's almost never related to actual objective stressful situations. It's things that I create in my mind. I like to joke that I could win the lottery and I would be stressed out about having to go to the bank. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. Yeah, I am a big fan of BetterHelp. I've been doing it for years. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, so give it a try and see if online therapy can help lower your stress. And this podcast, as I said, is sponsored by BetterHelp, and you guys get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp, at your first month, at betterhelp.com/mental. That's BetterHelp.com/mental.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And then finally, this is an awfulsome moment filled out by Dee Dee, and she writes, "When I was 16, I signed up for an after-school typing class. One day, as I was headed out the door for class, I grabbed a stack of paper from my parents' printer. At a stoplight, I noticed some writing on the paper. To my horror, it was a scathing letter that my mother wrote to a woman my dad was having an affair with, complete with references to fingernail scratches on my dad's back. I turned the car around and put the paper back where I found it. I didn't tell anyone about the letter for more than a decade. I quit the typing class and still blame that damn letter for my inability to type."
Your fear of death is your love of life in reverse.
I'm a kinky person.
I didn't want to be...
I'm ashamed.
A sexual being.
Deeply ashamed.
You are...
I want to live...
Fucking depressed.
But how?
I can't do this anymore.
I will be uncomfortable so you will be comfortable.
Is life just a series of perpetual losses?
You're not depressed. We're black.
There is no real chance for intimacy.
We don't do that.
Without risking being hurt.
Push it all down.
You can't go around it.
Ireland, like, we don't do mental health talk.
Through is the only path.
No one is ever alone. There's somebody else out there.
Don't forget.
Experiencing the same thing as you.
That the places you feel most broken now.
You just gotta look for them.
Will one day be your greatest strength.
And when you find them, it's a great feeling.
And I'm suddenly feeling horrible about making that joke, but that's how far I will go to get a laugh because I am empty inside.
Ah, you're in the right place.
I'm with Gabe Howard. Our paths crossed years ago, but we're finally sitting down and doing this. Gabe has a podcast called Inside Mental Health, and you are a fellow nut job. And it's nice we're finally sitting down and doing this. Among your potpourri of afflictions is bipolar. Bipolar 1 or Electric Boogaloo?
bipolar 1 is my official... Actually, I think my official diagnosis is bipolar with psychotic features. Mm. But we'll just go with bipolar 1 to not scare any listeners.
Gotcha. And for people that aren't familiar with the difference between bipolar 1 and bipolar 2, talk about that if you... would.
Yeah, so people want to say that bipolar 1 is more serious than bipolar 2, which that's kind of like determining what's more serious, falling down two flights of stairs or one flight of stairs. I think they're both pretty damn serious, right? The difference is bipolar 2 is suicidal depression all the way up to hypomania, whereas bipolar 1 is suicidal depression all the way up to like full blown mania. So hypomania is one step below I think I'm God and can fly, to put it in layman's terms. Yeah. And that's really the difference. There's some other slight differences here and there, but I do like to push back on this. Bipolar 2 is less severe than bipolar 1.
Okay.
Because I
and I'm guilty of saying that.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people say it, and I understand why. I really do, but I don't know. I think if it's happening to you, it's pretty severe. So
yeah. I heard somebody say one time there's two kinds of bipolar, the one that gets you promoted and the one that gets you fired.
There's so much we can say there, Paul. You know, mania just, oh man, mania has the best public relations team in the entire world, right? Because mania is just, it's so deadly. It hurts everything. It wrecks your damn life. But yet it's romanticized. People think it's fun and cool and you achieve so much. Mm-hmm. Yeah, none of that's true.
I think hypomania, that might be the case, you know, if assuming that you're not going to count the promiscuity and the credit card bills.
Right, right. So hypomania being that level below, there and you know, everything's on a spectrum, right?
Right.
So hypomania, like right at the beginning, there's sort of that ride the lightning that people
it's
kind
such
of describe.
An amazing feeling.
One, they're all amazing feelings. But
yes.
Like many things, just because it feels good doesn't mean that it is good.
Right.
Yeah, I think there is a little bit of harnessing at the beginning, that a lot of energy. And if you can keep focused and if you can keep moving forward and not, you know, start 37,000 projects at the same time, right? Then yeah, I think there is some harnessing that can be done. But I also wonder how many people are calling a lot of energy or a lot of enthusiasm or a lot of excitement, and they're just rebranding that as hypomania. Mm-hmm. Maybe they haven't hit the hypomania yet. Maybe
right.
They're like hypomania adjacent. But that's
yeah.
Yeah, you know, we could discuss that until we're purple.
And yeah, and I think it's important too to kind of take a break from talking about the labels and focus more on, is it making your life unmanageable? You know, which is kind of the criteria when you're talking about an addiction. You know, what's the difference between a heavy drinker and somebody who's an alcoholic? Well, only that person can really say whether or not that's the case. You know, a doctor could say, well, they're certainly showing signs of alcoholism, but there are people who you look at their drinking, you'd be like, wow, that's seems a little out of control, but that person is, you know, getting the shit done that they need to get done. They're not getting thrown in jail, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, like you were talking about, there's a continuum.
It's a small house, right? See, to a lot of my friends who live in places like LA, New York, San Francisco, my house is huge because it's like 3,000 square feet, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a huge house. But see, to Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Jeff Bezos, 3,000 square feet is a garage. So my house is small. look, my house didn't change sizes to go from huge to small. It stayed the same size. It's all about perspective. It's the same way with mental illness and mental health challenges, etc. If you come home and drink and you don't have kids, you don't have a wife and nobody's bothering you and it doesn't hurt you and your life is fantastic, then hey, drink. I mean, James Bond, he drinks constantly and he's like, what, 007, a world famous spy? But yeah, if you're neglecting your family, getting fired, if you're losing friends, if you yourself feel like shit all the time, then it really doesn't matter how much alcohol you're drinking. That alcohol is causing you a problem. Mental illness, much the same way. We all have to sort of choose our own adventure and figure out what recovery looks like to us. And I think that that gets missed in a lot of these conversations.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your personal story. You live in Ohio now. Were you raised in Ohio?
I was born in Pennsylvania, but raised in Ohio. So, you know, I like to give Pennsylvania a shout out just because it's forgotten so often.
And so what was family life like growing up?
Family life was stressful and not for any. These are such tough questions to answer because you're trying to take 18 years and, you know, fit it into a podcast that's not unwieldy. First and foremost, my mom got pregnant in high school. So my biological father, he had nothing to do with me. And that means that my mom remarried and I have red hair, which means I'm literally a redheaded stepchild. That alone says it all, right? The man who I call dad, he adopted me, right? He met me when I was 2.5. He adopted me when I was 5. He's the only father I've ever known. And he is a wonderful father. I love my dad. He's fantastic, right? Except here's the problem. He's a foot shorter. He's small framed. I'm large framed. Again, I'm the only redhead in the entire family. I'm the only one with a mental health diagnosis. I look different. I look different from my, I on visual inspection, you're like, what's up with that guy? Just 100% of the time. And that really started to, I became aware of that at a very young age, that I didn't look like the rest of my family. So when other things started happening, you know, I like books and my dad doesn't read. Oh, it's because he's not my, quote, real dad.
Yeah, and I love that you called your biological father your biological father, because it always irks me a little bit when people say my real dad, because that always feels like such a snub to the father that raised them and put all the work in.
This is brutal for me. So the dude that impregnated my mother, I call him my sperm donor. And that's just, I know it paints my mom in a bad light.
I like the word load shooter.
The guy who was there at time of conception, right? He was, look, not to be gross about it. He was a turkey baster, right? He did nothing for me except he was there at the moment of conception.
Right.
All right. Thanks, buddy. He gave me a set of genes and then didn't stick around to help me shape them in any way. The guy who adopted me, he's my real dad. You know, he's the guy that put up with the temper tantrums. He's the guy that saved me, along with my mother and other members of my family, and I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. They went through hell. When you ask how my childhood was, it was brutal. I didn't connect with my family. They didn't connect with me. Nobody understood mental illness, which means they tried to punish the symptoms of bipolar disorder out of me, which made me hate them. And they thought that I was just an asshole because I didn't listen to anything. And the biggest misunderstanding of all of this is that we each looked at the other side like they were the problem, when in reality, bipolar disorder was just standing there making fools of all of us. So by the time I hit adulthood, while we loved each other, honestly, we did not like each other very much. And that could have been the end of the story. And I'm so fortunate, Paul, that other stuff happened to bring us back together and make us realize that I wasn't an asshole and they weren't bad people.
Before we get to what changed, give me some snapshots of childhood when mental illness began to rear its head, what that looked like.
So imagine a teenager who thinks he knows everything. That's not an uncommon tale, right? But with mania and grandiosity, you don't think you know everything. You know you know everything. And the teenage years are brutal anyways. I don't think there's any adult, whether they have children or not, that doesn't think that the teenage years are brutal. And I was so arrogant because I was artificially inflated both by being a teenager and by being manic and having this grandiosity in me. And I screamed at them. I yelled at them. I ran away. I stole from them. I lied to them. And the way that they dealt with all of this was by punishing me, which of course just fueled my righteousness, because you can't punish the symptoms of bipolar disorder away. But here's what's kind of worse. And I think this is a thing that most people don't realize. See, bipolar disorder, it's secular. Right? Which means if I do absolutely nothing, I will cycle from manic to depressed to hypomanic to sad. And then, of course, right in the middle, normal, stereotypical. So my parents believed that their punishments or their guidance was working, not because it actually worked, but because I would just happen to cycle into...
Yeah, because a broken clock is right twice a day.
Exactly, exactly. So if you happen to be tinkering with the clock 1 minute before whatever time was on that clock, you thought your tinkering worked, which meant when you realized the clock was broken again, you would try that exact same tinkering. It wouldn't work the next time. And then you would become angry at the clock because, after all, you know the clock can do it. Because you saw the clock do it, and the clock is being belligerent. I don't even have words for how messed up all of this was, but it was brutal. It was brutal on all of us. And remember, I didn't say this, but I have two siblings. I have a brother and a sister. So it was brutal for them as well, because they were caught in the crossfire of this, which made me hate them, which made my parents defensive of them, which meant we fought and my parents had to get in the middle.
And it took attention away from them, probably.
It took a ton of attention away from them. Something that I regret to this day. Both attention from their older brother, like I would have liked to have been closer with them and got to know them more in my childhood rather than just hate them. I remember the part where I said that I was half adopted. Mm-hmm. See, the reason I thought we weren't close is because they got half their genes from this guy that I did not get my half of genes from. So in my mind, the reason that we weren't close is because we had different biological fathers. That had nothing to do with it. The reason we weren't close is because I was messed up and mom and dad were just constantly fighting with me. And then I would drop out of high school and run away. It was...
Where would you go when you would run away?
Yeah, there was this asshole, and there's... Once again, doesn't... Are we allowed to say asshole on your show? Yes. Your show seems like a show we can say asshole on, Paul. I thought I'd heard
you could
asshole.
Call him a fuckface if you wanted.
Listen, as a child, I thought he was just this amazing man, right? But as an adult, he was dangerous. He was a dangerous motherfucker. And I don't mean because he was gonna, you know, rob me or I don't mean anything like that. I mean, what he should have said is, look, you need to work this out with your parents. You can't come to my house. But instead, what he said is, your parents are assholes. You can come with me. And I would go live at his house for a couple of weeks until things would cycle. And I think, oh shit, mom and dad aren't so stupid. And then I would go back home. But
how old was he? How old were you? And what was the allure?
So he was 15 years older than me. So I would have been, you know, 18, and he would have been whatever 18 plus 15 was. Mm-hmm. Right. He was married with a couple of kids of his own, which makes him slightly more dangerous. I met him because he owned a computer business and I loved computers. Now I'm 45 years old, so you got to get a little bit in the mindset of pre-internet days. Mm-hmm. Finding people that had computers, understood computers, and would let you play with their computers was very rare. Computers cost thousands upon thousands of dollars in 1994 money, 1992 money, right? $5,000-$10,000 is a lot of money today. It was astronomical 30 years ago. And this man had access to all of these things. And I needed and wanted access to them. And he let me have access. At the time, I thought, no, I'm his protege. He's teaching me. I'm an intern. I'm his apprentice. In actuality, he was just using me for free labor and coming in between me and my parents. And it could have turned out very scary. The man did him no favors.
I was starting to wonder what his angle was. I was like, was Gabe getting groomed by this guy? But it was financial, not sexual.
Definitely. Sincerely, there's a lot of clarity in being 45 and looking back on my 15-year-old self. I worked for free. I worked for absolute free, and there wasn't a lot of people that could do these jobs. In some ways, I owe this man something because when I became an adult, I understood high-level networking, which got me jobs at places like CompuServe and America Online, and I managed global networks at the age of 19, which paid extremely well, and I learned all of that under him. So in a way, he did kind of fulfill his promise to me, but in actuality, he did it for his own gain. And I'm just lucky that I was able to take something away from it.
Gotcha. So give me some more snapshots of the unmanageability of, you know, maybe some mania snapshots or some, low point snapshots.
There's many, many stories that cycle around my family, and I don't even know how to just put them into words. There's a phrase that I haven't been able to escape in my family. It's called the wrath of Gabe. And that's because I would just fly off the handle. Everybody would just be sitting around talking about nothing, and Gabe would start screaming. And I need to own that. I don't mean yelling. I don't mean getting loud. I don't mean getting passionate. No, start screaming. And the listening would end no matter what, is screaming, you know, pounding the table. I don't think that I threw anything, but listen, if my mom called up right now and said Gabe threw something, I'd be like, yeah, I can't dispute that. I'm sure that happened. She's not a liar. And this would just come out of nowhere. Just nowhere.
Do you remember what you were feeling in your body when that would happen, or would you just kind of tune out?
A little bit of both. What I was feeling is attacked. What I was feeling is attacked, and that nobody's listening to me, and I have to make sure that they listen. And there was a protective factor in it too, both protecting me and them. See, they were wrong, and if I didn't set them straight, they were going to get hurt. Because remember, I know everything. So right. I can't let them be wrong, or they'll be in harm's way.
Ah, so you were feeling a sense of responsibility on top of all of that. You got to be the world's teacher.
Yeah, isn't that messed up?
Oh, that is such a burden to place on yourself. And people, that I think that's something that people who are codependent share as well. And they don't even realize the responsibilities that they take upon themselves. And that, you know, because if you look at somebody who's controlling, what is driving that controlling behavior? Is it the fear that, you know, if you don't keep things on the right track, there's going to be chaos and you're going to starve or you're going to die? Or is it that you feel like it's up to you to teach everybody to make the world a better place? Otherwise, you're a bad person. I mean, it can be so confusing, especially if you throw religion into it. Yeah.
Religion, politics, family, your sense of self-worth. See, remember, if mom and dad didn't listen to me, it meant they didn't love me. And you think, that makes absolutely no sense. And you're thinking, well, the stakes were high, right? Like your dad was getting ready to, I don't know, like drive with his eyes closed. And that, no. I told them that the movie Pulp Fiction was good and they didn't want to see it. That's an actual fight that happened in my house. I berated them for refusing to watch the movie because it was my favorite. It was my favorite movie and they wouldn't watch it. And you're thinking to yourself, okay, well, why didn't they just watch the movie? I mean, so they did, and they didn't like it. That means they rejected me. So I went from they didn't love me and wouldn't listen to me, so now they've rejected what I love. And this is, I don't even know if they remember this, but to this very day, there's like a part of me that is upset that they don't like Pulp Fiction, which is the dumbest thing ever. Who cares that they didn't like it? I don't like any music my dad likes once we get past like Elvis and the Beatles.
Right. So what changed? Was there a bottom? Was there an epiphany? Was there a moment of clarity?
I woke up in a psychiatric hospital. There was...
How old were you?
I was 29. Okay. 29.
Ooh, 20, that's a lot of years of tornadoes.
A brutal amount. And I did, of course, even more damage the amount of damage that I was able to do when my parents were around was frankly low, because once again, hindsight is always 20/20. They were incredible. The amount of interference that they ran was frankly professional levels.
Right.
They actually were saving me from myself in ways that I was completely unaware of. Well, they were gone. You know, once they finally got me through high school, which they, along with my grandparents, did, now I'm just alone and they were done. They're like, we got him through adulthood. We got him through high school. He's on his own. He's on his own. I don't mean that the way it comes out, but
no, I think, I think once a kid is out of the house, a certain amount of responsibility has to be taken by that kid for their relationships, their behavior, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, even when they're living in the house, they need to, you know, to kind of own their behavior. But yeah, I think anybody listening is thinking, yeah, right on for your parents. At some point, they had to save themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And remember, brother and sister, they had to save themselves and concentrate on my brother and sister. And also, my father was transferred away from Ohio all the way to Tennessee, about 700-mile distance, after I graduated high school. And I was an adult now, and I was graduated. So I stayed back and I was married. So the first thing I did with my newfound freedom of adulthood was get married right out of high school. So that marriage didn't last, because it turns out that women don't like to be married to untreated bipolars. It's a little known fact, but I feel that your listeners will benefit from understanding this. But that marriage was, It was awful for so many reasons. You know, one, the immaturity, the lack of understanding. Did I mention the untreated bipolar part? Mm-hmm. And I'm fairly certain that the number one reason that we got married was to piss off our parents. And that's always.
That's a great reason. Was it in the vows?
I don't really remember the vows, but I don't think it would surprise me if it was, to be honest. It ended poorly, and while we both made many, many mistakes, I'm not trying to take on all the responsibility. She did make mistakes of her own, but listen, I cheated on her. I've got to own that. I cheated on her. I screamed at her. I want to be clear, there was no physical abuse, but listen, really, that's like, hey, we got a divorce, but there was no physical abuse. But yeah, right. there was an emotional abuse component. Yeah. I screamed at her for everything. She took on the role of my parents, which again is always a healthy marriage. All the anger that I had toward the world and the wrath of Gabe moniker went on to her. So instead of sitting around with my parents and screaming for no reasons, I screamed at her. Now, my parents were adults, used to raising children and used to me and loved me unconditionally and frankly handled it better. She was just like, I don't, why is my husband screaming? And also she was young and inexperienced and had a different idea of how marriage was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So she just cried a lot. This is etched into my being for the rest of my life. I can never make amends for that. And I've tried. I don't even know how to end that story. It's so awful. Yeah. That's not a good time. That's not a good time in the life of Gabe.
You know, the fact that you are owning this and that you've had a shift in perspective and you've clearly rolled up your sleeves and done the work to try to manage your bipolar, and that you've taken a hard, painful look at your part in these things, that to me is the overwhelming factor in all of this. It's like, when we don't know, we don't know. But once we know, then the responsibility is really there to say, you know, I owe it to myself. I owe it to the people around me to do what it takes to keep myself as healthy as I can, and to make amends where I can. Did you make an attempt to make amends to her, or was she not talk to you?
I've made several attempts over the years, and she has I don't want to say that she has rejected them because that makes her sound mean,
she
right?
Probably she probably protected herself.
Yeah, she has declined them.
Yeah.
She is unwilling to believe that I am any different, that I have changed. She sees it as a potential setup or a way to get back in her life. And I can't fault her for that. The version of Gabe that she knows, she needs to protect herself from.
Yeah.
I sincerely wish that I could show her that I am not that guy anymore. But listen, that's not her responsibility.
Right.
Would I feel better if she did? Yeah, I'd feel way better. I think she would feel better too, but that's none of my business, right?
Right.
Paul, in many ways, it's my white whale. She's the only person that I'm aware of that I haven't been able to make up with or to explain to. I'm not saying that I got all my friends back that I lost or that, you know, that all of the relationships are where they could have been if all of these things that I had done hadn't have been done. But many of them have been repaired and we have, you know, a new normal, which I think people can really understand what a new normal is in the wake of COVID, but not that one.
So talk about your psych ward experience and what light bulbs went off or what changed.
So I woke up in a psychiatric ward and I didn't know anything about mental illness. I didn't know anything about mental. I didn't know anything. Right. But I did know one thing. I knew what TV taught me, and TV taught me that all psychiatric wards have ping pong tables. Now think about that, because, you know, in every pop culture representation, movies, television shows, whatever, it always shows the patients playing ping pong. Mm-hmm. Right. So when I woke up and realized where I was, I thought, okay, I need to center myself, make sure that everything's going to be okay. I just need to find the ping pong table, because once I find the ping pong table, all of the other things will come into place, right? And then I will know that television and movies are accurate, and I'll be able to make a plan with my extensive pop culture knowledge of,
right.
Yeah, you know where this is going. There was no ping pong table. And I walked around looking for this ping pong table, and I became more and more agitated and not finding it. An orderly came over and said, you know, sir, can I help you? And I said, yes, thank you. Where's the ping pong table? And I said, I'm sorry, sir, there's no ping pong table. And I said, well, there has to be a ping pong table. And he says, there's no ping pong table, you know, sharp corners, paddles, netting. You can't give psych patients all that. I said, yes, there must be a ping pong table. And he said, no. And listen, Paul, I'm 45 years old, and so many bad things have happened to me in my life. So many. And that's the worst one. And people say, how could finding out that there's no ping pong table be the worst thing that has ever happened to you? Because it meant that everything that I thought I knew about my brain, my thought process, the world, everything was wrong. I thought I knew what was happening in my mind. I didn't. And I had to, that was the moment. That was the moment when I realized I don't know what's going on and I'm not in control here. And that was particularly devastating because the day before, I thought I made my own decisions. I thought I controlled my own thoughts. I thought I saw the world the way that the world was. And then I realized that no, somebody else was at the controls. Bipolar disorder was, I was just a follower, and bipolar disorder was a leader that I didn't even know was around. Mm. And
were you hospitalized for mania or suicidal?
Suicide. I was hospitalized for suicidal ideation. Somebody recognized it that I was planning on killing myself. I know that it's vogue to clean things up with conscientious language and person first language, but listen, I wasn't, you know, planning to die by suicide. I was planning on killing myself, right? Mm-hmm. That's what was happening in that moment. And thankfully she saw it and did something about it.
Who is she?
A woman I was casually dating at the time, and she knew what to do. She just knew what to do. And, remarkably did something about it. She asked me, she said, are you planning on killing yourself? I said, yes. I thought about suicide as far back as I can remember, Paul. I never remember not thinking about suicide. So therefore I thought it was normal. Mm. I thought that everybody thought about suicide. I thought part of the human condition was considering killing yourself every single moment of every single day. When I looked at everybody else, I just assumed that they were doing it too. The example that I always use is, I have never seen most of the world go to the bathroom, but I assume and believe with every fiber of my being that every single human goes to the bathroom. So I would be shocked if I learned that, no, half the world doesn't urinate. Be like, what do you mean? I was raised to believe that they did. I urinate. I what do you mean? This would be shocking to me, as I imagine it would be shocking to everybody else.
Yeah.
That's how I thought about suicide. I thought it was like urination. Everybody did it. We just didn't talk about it.
Right.
It turns out that's not true. Most people do not want to die. So when she asked me, I said yes, because I thought I had help, right? I thought that she would, you know, I was curious as to who would find my body, but yeah, her. Yeah, I'll kill myself at noon. You show up at 12:30. Mm-hmm. This is a plan. I had some like paperwork I wanted to give to my mom. I was planning on leaving it on my kitchen table and just figured she'd find it. But no, this person can drop it off. Yeah, she freaked out. She was shocked. And she said, we need to go to the hospital. I said, why would we go to the hospital? I'm not sick. She said, oh my God, we need to go to the emergency room. I looked at her like she was nuts. I said, why would we go to the emergency room? The emergency room is where you go when you get in a car accident, right? Mm-hmm. The emergency room is where you go when you have a heart attack. The emergency room is not where you go when you make the very reasonable decision to end your own life. She did not agree with that. And I feel like not telling the rest of the story because it's part of my keynote speech. And I think, hey, if you want to hear the rest of it, you got to pay just like everybody else. But Paul, you're special. She tricked me. She tricked me. She said, I'll tell you what, let's go to the emergency room and we'll ask the doctor if this is where you need to be. If this is where you need to be, or if this is not where you're supposed to be, you win and I will buy you dinner wherever you want in the city. Mm-hmm. Listen, even in my delusional, depressed and suicidal state, I still had the overwhelming desire to be right and to win an argument and, well, frankly, to get a free meal. So we hopped in the car, we went to the emergency room and you all know how the story ends. I was committed that evening.
So what changed? You had that epiphany, your ping pong table moment. And so you started listening to the doctors? Did you start taking meds? What was the new plan of attack?
The next thing that happened, I was left alone with my thoughts for a few hours. And then I met with the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist, you know, sits you down like the psychiatrist does in a mental hospital, and says you've been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Now, at the time, I'd only ever known one person to be diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and that was a gentleman by the name of Kurt Cobain. He was the lead singer for the alternative rock band Nirvana. He had bipolar disorder, and he had recently died by suicide. So when I heard this, I just assumed I was dead, because I figured, you know, Kurt Cobain was rich. Kurt Cobain was famous. Kurt Cobain was a once-in-a-lifetime musical talent, and he couldn't beat bipolar disorder. I'm some schlub from Ohio. I'm not a once-in-a-lifetime anything, so I really thought it was a death sentence. I didn't know anybody living well with mental illness or bipolar disorder. There was no hopeful stories. It was a shit show in my mind. The next thing is that I thought, oh my God, I could have hurt my family. I could have hurt somebody. Mm-hmm. See, I really linked mental illness and violence as hand in hand.
Yeah, which is such a myth.
It's an incredible myth, but I believed it. I feel like a hypocrite now teaching people that that's not true, knowing that for 28, 29, 30 years of my life, I perpetuated that very myth just boldly. And every time I saw the news, that guy must be crazy, gotta be schizophrenia. I can hear myself saying it. I was such an asshole believing this, but nobody told me any differently. Nobody challenged me. Nobody corrected me, which allows the myth to persist. Because I believed it, I thought, oh my God, I could have killed somebody. I really, really believed it. So just imagine that feeling just for a moment of realizing, doesn't matter that it's not true, but of realizing that your actions could have led to somebody's death. That's hard to sit with while already thinking that you're going to die from bipolar disorder And by the way, you're committed to a psychiatric hospital. And earlier that morning, you learned you weren't in control of your own brain. It was a particularly difficult moment, to say the least. And it stuck around for almost a day. I would have given anything, Paul, to have any story, anything, somebody who was living well, just somebody I could think of. Well, wait a minute. Bob has bipolar. Oh, yeah, Bob. Yeah, you know, Bob, the real estate agent. He's got that beautiful wife and three kids and a dog. Doesn't he have that nice house on the court? Yeah, I didn't have any of that. There was none of that. I had all the horror stories. I had the dead guy. And then I had me locked in a psych ward. Yeah, it was lonely, hopeless. I hear myself telling the story, and I just don't think I'm doing justice to how I felt. It was painful. The feeling was physically painful in my body.
And so what did the psychiatrist suggest? What was the...
I was put on medication. Mm-hmm. I was put on medication, and I was sent to, I was still in the hospital for 2.5 more days, mm-hmm. roughly. So I was given medication that very moment. I think the psychiatrist might have handed me my first meds. But I took them pretty quickly, and I said, okay, I trusted the doctor. I didn't have any issue with that. And then I was told that I needed to go to a support group, which met the next morning. And the reason that I remember the support group is because that was the first place that I ever heard anything positive about bipolar disorder. And very specifically, there was this woman. This woman was probably 10 years older than me, you know, maybe 40 years old, 35, 40, maybe she's only, you know, 5 or 6 years older than me. But, you know, you do this check-in in support groups. People who haven't mm-hmm. been in support groups, one of the things you do around, you know, hi, my name is Gabe Howard. I live with bipolar disorder. And this has been a rough couple of weeks or, you know, just whatever. Mm-hmm. Or this has been a good couple of weeks. You do this little 1-minute check-in. She said, you know, hello, my name is a name I can't remember. I live with bipolar disorder. And this has been a good week, but it's been kind of stressful. You know, my husband and I, we've been having trouble connecting, and the kids are getting on my nerves, and work has been tough. I feel like I have no energy at the end of the day, and my house is really messy, and I know I need to let that go. Now, listen, I don't give a shit about any of that. Here's what I heard. I live with bipolar disorder. I have a spouse. I have a couple of kids. I have a job, and I have a house. I want all of those things. You have bipolar disorder and all of those things. Listen, it's so much easier to jump off the cliff if you see other people do it first and they have fun and they live. Then all of a sudden you're like, I want to jump off the cliff too. I didn't think you could jump off a cliff and live. I didn't think it was possible. I thought 100% of people who jumped off cliffs died. And then I saw this beautiful cliff diver. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is amazing. I want to go to there. And these were the first hopeful moments. And I started finding more and looking around for more. And it took a lot because the negativity just had been pulverizing me for decades. But the light started to shine through. And this became the basis for very slow forward movement. When I was released from the hospital, and I always like to say that began my 4-year epic battle against bipolar disorder, because it really did take 4 years from being diagnosed to reaching recovery. It was a very long process.
Physically, in terms of brain chemistry, or you know, socially, inwardly.
I think it's an all of the above thing.
That makes sense.
First and foremost, you know, medication is not like what people think. Medication is portrayed so terribly on television. First off, I'm saying medication because I think all medication is portrayed terribly on television, but it's a mental health podcast. So mental health medication is portrayed terribly on all pop culture everywhere because the person is acting erratically. Somebody invariably says, have you taken your meds today? That person reaches into their pocket or in a cabinet, takes the meds, and instantly they're fixed. Look, headache medication doesn't work that way. right? It barely. You have a headache, you take medication, and maybe a half an hour later, the headache goes away, but it's not instant. It's not, and really, severe and persistent mental illness and headaches are not even in the same conversation. They're not even in the same ballpark. They're not the same sport. But people think that they are. People think that if you just take your meds, you'll be fine. First off, you have to take the right meds in order to be fine. Mm-hmm. And that's not so easy. It's not so easy to find those right meds because I'm on 7 different medications.
Yeah, it's a lot of trial and error, a lot of patience.
A ton of trial and error. And I don't think people understand that in between each trial and error, in the best of circumstances, is 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And that means that you can get into a psychiatrist every 6 to 8 weeks. So if you're on 7 medications and the doctor magically gets it right every single time, 6 times 7 is what, 42? Did I do the math right? That's almost a year. And that's assuming that your doctor is magical and doesn't need to adjust anything, doesn't need to, and of course, that you can get into a psychiatrist every 6 weeks, which is not
or even easiest. Afford one.
Well, yeah. I haven't ripped the Band-Aid off that one yet for your audience, but yeah. I was very fortunate, and I could see a psychiatrist with decent regularity. I really was seeing a psychiatrist every couple of months, but the med would work a little bit, or the med would have a horrible side effect. We'd have to change it. We'd have to raise it. We'd have to lower it. So all of that takes time. Now let's move that aside. I hate this magic pill theory. Yeah. Oh, you've got mental illness? Just get on meds and you'll be fine. Right. Medication is extremely important for a lot of people living with bipolar disorder. I would not be here without it. But I also would not be here if after the medication allowed me to control my mind, I didn't learn all new coping skills. All of my previous coping skills involved, eating, doing drugs, drinking, screaming at people. That was a good coping skill. You have made me sad. I will yell at you. That's not a good coping skill.
Yeah, I like to look at meds as, they don't get us to the finish line. They just get us to the starting block, rather than in the parking lot while the gun, goes off. It gives you a mildly firm footing to then deal with all the shit that life throws at you.
Exactly. And there's a relearning process as well. These medications are extremely powerful, and they need to be because we're dealing with a very serious illness. But if the medication has the power to change the way your brain works to make you healthy, that by definition means that you need to relearn how to control that brain. Mm-hmm. Because the brain that you're used to controlling, or the brain that I was used to control, it was defective. It was very, very defective. The example that I always use is, imagine if your power steering goes out, right, in your car. So in order to make like a really hard left, you're putting all of your muscle into it. You're using both arms. You're grabbing your it's really hard because the power steering is out, right? So you're just doing all of this effort, but the car does turn left, right?
Right.
And then after a year, somebody notices this and they're like, dude, I feel so bad for you. I will fix that. That is fantastic. But that means that if you grab the steering wheel and yank as hard as you can now that the power steering works, you will wreck because you don't need to do that anymore.
Right.
So you essentially have to retrain your brain to just, do the slight little wheel adjustment and make the normal left turn that everybody else has been making their entire lives. That takes time. That's not instant.
Yeah, it does. And in my opinion, it's a lifelong process. It is a lifelong process, but fortunately it's not like a switch turning on or off. It's more like a dimmer, and it's nice because you get positive feedback in terms of feeling the things in your life that seemed unattainable before: peace, tranquility, lack of drama, things that were just like, it's like you almost resigned yourself to never being happy, just somebody that joy was not a part of your plan in life. And when you do get to experience moments like that, it sometimes a spiritual component can come into your life, and you can get in touch with, or at least believe that there's some benevolence in the universe, not just chaos and curse.
When things start to change, for me, two things happened. One, I was so happy. I mean, literally, I was so happy that the world wasn't what I thought, because it was kind of brutal out there for me for a long time. So that was very pleasing, very, very pleasing. And then I looked backwards at the damage. And now that I could see it with clear eyes, all of a sudden, mom went from a bitch and dad went from an asshole to mom and dad went, they became saviors. I couldn't believe how cruel I was to the people who literally were saving my life on a daily basis. And I don't even know how to make amends for that.
Do you remember the first conversation you had with them?
I don't remember the first conversation. I remember posting something on Facebook. I don't know if this was the first conversation or not. See, I really want to say that my parents didn't expect an apology. Like in a way, this was like the cool thing about them. They were just like, Gabe's getting better and we're happy. All right, good. We're good. You never owed a debt, so we never expected payment.
Right.
Now I went ahead and paid back the money anyway. That money is figurative in this situation. But they did not expect it. But I remember posting something on Facebook where I said, if you think you don't love your parents, or I'm going to butcher it, but I said, if you think that your parents aren't in your corner, ask yourself this question. If you're trapped on the fourth floor of a burning building and you look out the window, do you want to see them there? Yes or no? If the answer is yes, then your parents are better than you think. And this sparked a lot of conversation on social media. But the reason that I said that is because I thought that my parents were meaningless and worthless and did nothing for me. Mm-hmm. But I realized that every single time I got in trouble, I looked up and I expected to see them there. And when I saw them there, I was relieved. I was relieved. And I've got so many examples of that. And my mom saw that. And she was like, well, would you be happy if your dad and I were outside? And I said, yes. And I said, in actuality, it's a really dumb question, because if I was on the fourth floor and the building was on fire, I would not see you and dad outside, because you'd already
be
in
looking
the building
for a ping pong table.
Yeah. I mean, fire buildings have to have ping pong tables. They'd already be inside. It wouldn't occur to them not to be. I couldn't see them because they wouldn't just be standing there staring at me like dumbasses, right? They'd save my life, and I just took that for granted. And my mom said, "Well, I didn't know you felt that way," and I said to my mom, "I didn't know I felt that way either. I really didn't. It's been a lot of therapy to realize that you and dad were actually so good at what you did. I didn't even recognize you were doing anything." And I then realized that, you know, my dad is my dad is my dad is my dad. I forget that he's not my biological father. I just do. So much so that, you know, now that I've reached the age where people are taking medical histories, I get halfway through my dad's medical history before I say, never mind. He's not my biological. You know how many charts out there? Like, father has asthma.
Right.
Yeah. No, what I need to say is father died of alcoholism and liver cancer, because genetically my biological father died of liver cancer due to alcoholism. That's what they want. They don't give a shit that the man who raised me.
Right.
But I forget.
And so where do you feel like you're at today? And where is your, like today in terms of your energy level, would you put it? Because you have a lot of energy, you know, right now.
I've been called loud.
Yeah. and that's not a criticism. It's just more of an observation. Some people, you know, are engaged and animated, and other people are kind of chilled and lay back. But I imagine some people
listening to this would go, well, I wonder if he's a little bit manic because, you know, his energy is so up there. And I hope that's not, that doesn't come across as a criticism.
This is, I think, one of the most difficult parts of managing any mental illness, right? I don't think that people really have a good understanding of what the terms mean, right? Depression doesn't mean sadness. You tell people, hey, I'm depressed, and they're like, you know, I'm depressed too.
Right.
And I'm like, no, I'm clinically depressed.
Right.
I have major depression. You're sad. And they're like, well, I don't understand. The same thing happens with mania, right? Mick Jagger is not manic. But the man's 78 years old and still runs across the stage screaming, I can't get no satisfaction, to this giant band. And I understand why people want to use that as an example of mania.
Right.
I mean, the lights going off, 80,000 people screaming the song, this guy holding a microphone. I mean, there's even a whole song, Moves Like Jagger, right? The man is not manic. Right. He just has that performance energy.
Right.
I am not manic. I just have a lot of energy. I'm an extrovert. I love people. And
you're
passion.
An advocate
yeah.
for this. But I wanted to bring that up as an interviewer because I thought some people are probably going to think, is that guy taking his meds? You know, he's amped up. But, you know, I get that way sometimes. I've never experienced, you know, full-blown mania. I've experienced hypomania. But sometimes if I'm talking about guitar or hockey or mental health, you know, I'll go on a rant and be really, really forceful about what I'm talking about. And so that's why I wanted to mention it.
I think it's a good thing to mention, and it's understandable why it would come up. And as a person who lives with bipolar disorder and considering what I've put my family through, I do understand why when they see certain things that are reminiscent of other things, their trauma goes off. Right? I know we're talking about the audience, but, you know, fuck the audience. We're going to talk about my family for a moment. Mm-hmm. You know, when I get like real ramped up or real angry or real passionate about something, I understand why they go to, uh-oh. Are we seeing the mm-hmm. de-evolution of Gabe's stability? Is this the first step in what's going to end up with Gabe back to the way he was? I understand why they feel that way. But the flip side to that is that's like a real burden, right? Mm-hmm. I'm never allowed to be passionate for fear that people will think I'm manic.
Right.
I'm never allowed
right.
to be angry for fear people will think that I'm being violent.
Right.
It's very, very difficult to manage because people make these assumptions about you when they hear that you have bipolar disorder. And one of them is excitement is mania. Nope. Excitement is just excitement. But again, let's flip it back the other way. If I do start exhibiting symptoms of bipolar disorder, like I'm de-escalating, sliding, or I'm going mm-hmm. back, I do want them to stop me. So what do I do? And the answer is, I ask them to be real sure before they say anything to me, mm-hmm. and I listen to them with grace, and I don't get angry at them, even if I am angry. Because sometimes I'm just like, I can't believe you're asking me this. Look, I'm allowed to be pissed off, all right? That thing that happened angered everybody in the room, but you're worried about me.
Mm-hmm.
But I put that trauma trigger there. I didn't do it on purpose. But I put it there.
And the thing that I like about that is that you are reminding yourself that they're well-meaning. And that's, I imagine, one of the tools that you developed in your recovery was to suss out, you know, what is my filter? What am I filtering reality through? Even when I'm stable and on my meds, you know, what's my historical negative belief about myself and others?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult to figure out where those boundaries are. I am extraordinarily fortunate now because I'm married. I've been married for a decade. She does not have any mental health issues. She didn't know me when I was really, really sick. She's taken all sorts of mental health classes. She's learned from the greatest mental health advocate in the world, Paul Gilmartin, who listens to your show. No.
I suddenly think less of her.
You know, me too, actually. I'm a mental health advocate too. What the hell, lady? But seriously, she's done a really great job of educating herself. But I point this out because now she can be a gatekeeper. So now when other people around me that knew me then are worried something's up, rather than coming to me, they can go to her. Yeah. And she is the one person that has 100% access. I do not get to tell her no. That's the agreement. Mm-hmm. If she comes up to me and says, Gabe, I think you're manic. You need to go to the doctor right now. It does not matter how passionately I disagree with her. Mm-hmm. It does not matter if I am 100% right and I have the full backing of the General Assembly of California saying, you're wrong, lady. I have to listen to her. That's the deal. And who cares? Let's say that she's wrong. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And she's never had to invoke this, knock on wood, but she's allowed to ask me questions that other people are not allowed to ask me, but everybody's allowed to ask her. So it's a cool role
That's
for
awesome,
her to
man.
Agree to take
That's
on.
That's awesome. She sounds like a really lovely woman.
Again, she has no mental health issues except that she married me. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's break this down. No mental health issues, but she agrees to marry a guy who's twice divorced, best friends with his ex-wife, has been committed to a psychiatric hospital and has bipolar disorder. And by the way, is a redhead. There's something wrong with her. I don't know what that's called, but it will be in the DSM-6. And
she loves charity.
That is true. She is a very good person.
Yes.
Oh, wow. I'm her pet project. I am her Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which also ended in divorce. Oh, shit. I don't like this at all, Paul. I don't like this at all.
I think this would be a nice awkward moment to end the interview on. Buddy, I'm so glad we were able to make this happen. And just kudos on all the work you've done. And getting out there and speaking and doing the podcast, Inside Mental Illness.
Inside Mental Health.
Inside Mental Health.
You own Mental Illness and all podcasts right. with Mental Illness Happy Hour. Yeah. If I called it Inside Mental Illness, people would be like, you copied off Paul.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people call it the Mental Health Happy Hour.
Those people are wrong.
Yeah, they are wrong.
Super wrong.
Yeah.
I'm Inside Mental Health because I'm educational. Your Mental Illness Happy Hour because it's a happy hour.
I'm hopeless.
Hour.
I'm hopeless.
You're hopeless. You're entertaining and I'm boring. That makes people want to tune in. No, but sincerely, I know it's a shameless plug, but I'm just going to take it. It's a cool educational show, and it's like a 25-minute lift.
Yeah.
And you know who's going to be on it?
Who?
Paul Gilmartin.
I can't wait.
It's going to be fat. You know, you're a returning guest.
Yeah.
You were on it before. I almost never have anybody on it twice. You're in a very rare club, sir.
I like it.
I like it too.
And if people want to hire you to speak, they do it through your website or the podcast.
Yeah, GabeHoward.com.
GabeHoward.com. And people can follow you on social media at?
GabeHoward29.
GabeHoward29.
Yeah, I was 29 years old when I created all this.
We figured that.
Yeah. I wasn't born in 1929. I don't want that image stuck in people's... You know, millennials are doing that, right?
Yeah.
Like my wife, everything is 85 because she was born in 85. Mm-hmm. I'm like, whereas I'm 29. So I'm like, what if like young people are like, we can't hire him. He was born in 1929.
Yeah. People knew you were manic because of how hard you were doing the Charleston.
I rocked it out before rock. Yeah. So.
Thanks, Gabe.
Many, many thanks to Gabe.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Let's do some surveys. This is from the Misophonia survey. For those of you who aren't familiar with the term, it's a sound sensitivity. And this was filled out by a woman who calls herself Sad Cat. What noises trigger you? Chewing, taking the pen cap on and off. Any repetitive sounds. Yesterday, a girl was putting down cards on a table loudly for 5 minutes, and it bothered the shit out of me.
when people rub their feet together and their socks make sounds, excessive finger cracking, snoring, huge one for me, squeaky things that aren't supposed to be squeaky, wheels on grocery carts, etc., scratching sounds on really dry skin. Is your relationship with the person making the noise affected by their noises? It used to be just my dad that I would get triggered with, but now it's everyone. Are you comfortable telling people about your sound sensitivity? Sometimes. It usually pops up when I'm in PHP, which is a partial hospitalization, groups for therapy because there's a lot of anxious people there and they shake their foot when and if I feel comfortable with the group, I tell them kindly. I always feel like I'm being high maintenance. What have the reactions been when you've told people? They don't know what it is. They say, okay, tell me if I'm ever doing anything, and then they usually forget right away. Do you have other sounds, other sensory sensitivities, smell, touch, taste, sights, etc.? Yes, exclamation point. Sights, exclamation point. Repetitive movements bug the crap out of me. Shaking legs, rubbing feet together, even just the circling your ankle around multiple times. Finger picking and skin picking. Have you ever struggled with food issues? Yes, I've struggled since I was 12. I'm 21. It goes back and forth between restricting and then binging with a few purges. How long have you had misophonia? Since I can remember, I think it started to get really bad at 8. How many times a day do you get triggered? Depends on the environment. If I'm home, isolating, 0. If I'm home and I'm hanging with my parents, probably 3 or 4. And if I'm in treatment, probably 7+. Do you feel guilty about your triggers or the way you respond to them? Yes. I feel like people deal with anxiety in different ways. And when I tell them about misophonia, I feel like I'm saying, stop feeling anxious. Have you been diagnosed with a mental or physical health disorder or issue? And if so, do you believe it's connected to your misophonia? Depression, anxiety, PTSD, eating disorder, unspecified. I don't think it's connected. Well, I guess it makes my anxiety start/go up when someone is making a noise or doing something that triggers me. Do you have a history of trauma, sexual, physical, emotional, or emotionally disinterested or unavailable parents? I was sexually assaulted by an ex-boyfriend at 15 on Halloween. My parents were workaholics and didn't give me a lot of attention when I needed it. Also, they invalidated me or would try to stop making me feel sad. Did you ever experience trauma to the ear, for instance, a loud sound prior to the onset of your misophonia? No. Have you tried any kind of therapy, medications, or tools for your misophonia? No, I've told a few psychiatrists, but no one seems to know about it and doesn't really seem to care either. Thank you for sharing that. And thanks to the listener who suggested and helped me put that survey together. This is from the Hall of Fame Awfulsome Moments. My girlfriend told me last week, she's like, by the way, that one awfulsome moment that you read, that's the third time you've read that. I was like, oh my God, welcome to my golden years. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by Shepherd. And it was years ago that we read this one, but I'm reading it again because we're a little low on awfulsome moments. And he writes, when one of my best friends had died in high school, during the candlelight vigil in the parking lot, someone began singing that dreadful Sarah McLachlan song that's in the ASPCA ads. Before anyone else joined in, someone else blurted out, he hated that fucking song. Stop singing it before I shove that candle up your ass. Everyone started laughing so hard that the tears of sadness became tears from laughing, and what started out as a solemn moment turned into a night where we reminisced about all the wild, hilarious hijinks that he was notorious for. I think he would have approved, especially about the candle. Awfulsome. That is awfulsome. Thank you for that. This is from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Childhood. Fuck that. He identifies as bisexual. He's in his 20s, says that he was raised in a stable and safe environment, but I would question that. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? He writes, some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts. I don't really remember what happened, but I remember being in a constant state of fear growing up. My mom would always fly off the handle for practically anything. She'd scream at us and hit us. Then she'd calm down and apologize and pretend like everything was okay, but it wasn't. Rinse and repeat. He's been physically abused and emotionally abused. Deepest, darkest thoughts. Sometimes I think about hurting people and myself, but then I feel guilty about it. Darkest secrets. I'm pretty sure I was raped as a kid. Most of my childhood is a black hole, but there are pockets of memories, none of them good. I've had nightmares about being sexually abused, and my porn addiction is influenced by those thoughts. My therapist asked me to go to an SLAA group meeting, and I plan to. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you, incest porn or MILF porn, but it grosses me out that I like that. I would say people who aren't bothered by what turns them on are probably in the minority. That's just an educated guess, but what, if anything, would you like to say to someone that you haven't been able to? I don't think that there is any point to do that. What, if anything, do you wish for? To be mentally healthy. Have you shared these things with others? My therapist, and she is helping me through it. How do you feel after writing these things down? Shitty. Well, buddy, I appreciate you taking the time to fill that out. And I really hope you do follow through on going to that support group. This is a happy moment filled out by Mother's Perfect Doll. And she writes, I was curled up next to my boyfriend watching him play video games on his laptop. I watched as he calculated every move and hit the keys with precision. We would celebrate every level he cleared and gave each other a kiss. He would be beaming with joy. I retold his moment to my therapist, and as I was saying it, I realized that 3 years ago I was on food stamps and hating myself. I hated myself so much that I was convinced that no one would ever love me. If your own mother doesn't love you, how can anyone else? I remember feeling a strong sense of disgust towards Valentine's Day, an intense panic around Christmas as I tried to figure out who actually loved me enough to want me to be in their presence for the holidays. My therapist started cheering me on and pointed out how much I have grown since starting, and naturally, I deflected since compliments are hard. Still sitting next to my boyfriend while I watch him play his games made me feel something that I can so describe as love. That's beautiful. That was beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. This is from the first day in therapy survey filled out by a woman in her 20s. And what brought you to therapy? Quarter life crisis. She's between 18 and 25. Quarter life crisis. I've never felt so unmotivated, unsure, and unhappy with my life. Any fears associated with starting therapy? I thought my problems and feelings were not worth the effort to see a therapist. I was afraid that those fears would be realized and that the therapist wouldn't understand how heavily it's impacted me. Did any of those fears come true? Somewhat. I felt like the weight of my thoughts and troubles wasn't really being understood. That might also be my fault. Perhaps I didn't explain how I truly felt or didn't explain it in enough detail. What has worked best for you in therapy? It was great being able to share my true feelings without worrying about how this might impact my relationships. I felt like I could finally be honest with myself, and to be able to externalize those thoughts and feelings without worry is just, excuse me, is just such a great feeling. What were your initial impressions of your therapist? I thought my therapist was really kind and compassionate. I was presently surprised at how composed he was, even when I was bawling my eyes out. Do you feel you can be completely honest with your therapist? Yes, my therapist is a neutral person in my life. No affiliation with any friends or family. I feel less anxious and less afraid of saying something that might affect my relationships, so I feel like I can be honest. Anything you'd like to share with a group of new therapists? A friendly smile and a touch of kindness can go a long way. Thank you for that. This is from the Shame and Secret Survey, and this one is a bit intense and has some graphic parts in it. This is filled out by a woman who calls herself Coasting Through Failure. She identifies as straight. She's in her 20s, was raised, she says, in a pretty dysfunctional environment. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? One instance, yes, and never reported it. And in another instance, some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts. She writes, I lost my virginity when I was 12 years old to a boy who pressured me into it. To make matters worse, his aunt walked in on us and scolded me, but didn't tell my parents. I never had the voice to say no. When I was 14, I cut school and drank vodka for the first time at a friend's house, just us girls. I drank too much, not knowing any limits, being that I had never drank before, and end up yakking away in her bathroom. Her older brother came in and held my body up by my chin, tilted it back, and put his dick in my mouth. He was in his 20s. This time, I had no control over my body or my voice. I tried telling my friend afterwards, but was shrugged off. When I was 17, some guy followed me into the bathroom. I pulled my pants on immediately, and he pushed me against the wall and forced his hands into my pants. He grabbed at all of me. This time was different. I fought him off, but then a woman walked in and held the bathroom door shut. I've never felt so betrayed by a stranger. I fought her off too and ran out of the party into the street and just kept running. I slept at the train station until it opened the next morning. I was too ashamed to call anyone for help. I deserve what happened because I had flirted with him earlier that night. Wow, I'm so sorry that that happened to you. And, you know, there are a lot of analogies for the self-blame that you are unfairly putting on yourself, saying that you deserve what happened because you flirted with that guy. You know, that's would be like saying, well, you know, I agreed to have a doctor take my tonsils out, so I can't complain that he sawed my arm off. She's been physically abused and emotionally abused. All my boyfriends hit me. They roughed me up and punched me and have been overly aggressive during sex. So many of my relationships have been emotionally abusive, including with my mom. My boyfriends all seem to have the same idea about me, which made me feel certain it was true. I would never find anyone better than them, never be worth anything to anyone, and should feel lucky to even be in their presence. My mom always made me feel like something was wrong with me. When she found out that I wasn't a virgin, she backed me into a corner, smacked me around, and called me a slut. Through my teenage years, there was a lot of name-calling, slut and bitch leading the pack. Any positive experiences with abusers? Well, it wouldn't be abuse if I didn't also love my abusers, now would it? My mom always called me her twin as well. The irony in that. She has always been fun, confident, and full of energy. All the things that I am not. Everyone likes her. She has no idea that I consider her abusive. Darkest thoughts. Hurting my children or seeing them being hurt and not helping. They are the single most important thing I've ever had, and sometimes I imagine them falling down a flight of stairs, a sinkhole swallowing them up, or them flying out of a car window during an accident. Other times I wonder what child molesters would think while looking at my children. I know I am not attracted to them in that way at all, but I feel like I can somehow protect them more if I understand what evil demon molesters think. I hate myself for it. Darkest secrets. I overheard an argument between my parents. My mom was yelling at my dad because she caught him wearing my underwear. She was accusing him of being turned on by his own daughter. I was a teenager at this time, but I also remember feeling my dad's boner through his pants when I sat in his lap as a small child, maybe 5 years old. He never touched me or looked at me lustfully, so I still have no idea what to make of it. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. I think about a huge gangbang with men of all shapes, sizes, and colors lining up for me. It makes me feel gross, and I could never want that in real life, but when I think of it, I imagine myself feeling powerful. Then that turns to shame immediately after thinking so. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I would like to blame my mom for everything, the way she blames everyone and everything else for everything. Even if it truly isn't at all her fault, I want her to take my shame and guilt from me and martyr herself as I would for my children. What, if anything, do you wish for? I wish I could smile and feel free like those bitches in the medication commercials, even for just one day. Have you shared these things with others? I have shared with my husband only, who is not abusive at all and has some experience with mental health services. I feel that I earned him, truly a great husband, from all the years of bullshit I endured. He is wildly supportive. How do you feel after writing these things down? Kind of freaked out, like maybe I am over-exaggerating, and also still not sure if these experiences count as abuse. Yes, they absolutely count as abuse. I have heard horror stories from close female friends and have always thought, wow, I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm 30 years old and just realized that these occurrences weren't my fault. Still halfway, trying to convince myself that's true. Anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? It would be like that meme where they show two friends giving each other meaningful advice when neither of them actually know shit. So no. Thank you for filling that out. And I really hope you're on the path of having compassion for yourself, because I think for a lot of us, that's the beginning of turning the corner. I mean, nothing will keep us stuck like, you know, telling ourselves that the abuse was our fault. This is from the love survey filled out by Rednecks Leg Syndrome. And they write, I love noticing other people's faces lit up in the busy streets as they get excited over my dog Haggis. Most of the time, they don't even look at me, and that's great. I love having him off the leash in the park where he can run freely. He's so full of joy and carefree. I love talking to my friend about a new mental illness happy hour episode and sharing what we can relate to. I love the work that's involved in grinding your own coffee beans and how it sometimes makes the coffee taste way better. I love listening to people talk about what they love or what they're really passionate about. I love when my boyfriend leaves early in the morning and I get to turn around again and sleep a bit longer. I love the feeling of being in a sauna that's almost too hot to handle. So hot, it's hard to breathe, but still feels so good. That is an awesome one. I love when a podcast or song ends just as I put the keys on the lock and get home. I love cooking a healthy meal that I know is nourishing my body and mind. And I love when I finally stop procrastinating and work on my thesis, even if it's just writing a paragraph. And then I reward myself with taking a month off. That's fantastic. And then finally, this is an awfulsome moment from the past. We read this one years ago. This is filled out by a woman who calls herself Fran Baxter. And she writes, I lost my husband to suicide a few weeks ago. He ended his years-long battle with chronic pain and depression on his terms, being kind enough to spare me from having to find him or identify his body. I forgave him, even though I miss him dearly. He's out of pain and with a lot of people he admired and the cats that we loved. A dear friend who was a lover before I met my husband came over today on his way to visit a relative. I wanted to experience intimacy with someone I trusted as a way of helping me grieve, and my friend was happy to oblige me. We had no set expectations except showing each other enthusiastic consent. I had a feeling I'd cry a few times, in parentheses, sense memory triggers, and I did. My friend was as kind and loving as he was nearly half my life ago. After the really great sex was over, I could faintly hear my husband's voice. See, I told you my cock wasn't as special as you thought it was. You came just as easily just now as you did with me. I couldn't help but laugh and share that with my friend. My husband knew me better than I knew myself sometimes, and it is awfulsome to know that he was right about this too. It is also awfulsome to be able to fuck another man again because my marriage vows have expired. Oh, thank you for that. I love any podcast episode that ends with a little cock. Is that wrong? If that's wrong, I don't want to be right. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Thank you to everybody that makes this podcast possible. Thank you to our monthly donors and our one-time donors. If you're ever interested in helping the show financially, just go to our website, metalpod.com, and you can donate through PayPal or Patreon. And you can donate by taking the surveys. That is a nice non-financial way that you can help out the podcast, especially the happy moments and awfulsome moments and loves surveys, because those are my favorites. And never forget that you're not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely.